With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome back to The Front Three. Yes, we are back in a revised format where we're going to be discussing the three biggest talking points of the weekend. Of course, I am Statman Dave. Today, I'm joined by Chris Hennage and Nico Morales. Chaps, how's it going?
Yeah, not bad, thanks.
How you doing, Dave?
Yeah, I'm good. A little bit of a delayed response there, a little bit of a phone call. But anyway, let's move on to the talking points of today's action. Of course, it is transfer window time. The clicks are flying around the internet. There is clickbait at every single corner of the world wide web. But we're going to go through that clickbait and we're going to divulge which is right and which is wrong. And we're going to sort of work out which is the best deal of the window so far and which will be the best deal in the final week of the window. Okay, the big moves so far, of course, Alexis Sanchez joining Manchester United and Henrik Mkhitaryan going the other way in a big, big swap deal in the Premier League. But first of all, chaps, I think we want to touch on the Arsenal moves this week. Aubameyang apparently on his way to Borussia Dortmund. Chris, can he replace Alexis Sanchez's goals and how important will he be for Arsenal going forward if he joins?
I think he'll be huge for them. He fits their system quite well. He is a very different player to Alexis Sanchez. You have to keep that in mind, though. He's not someone in my mind that necessarily lifts a team on his own, but at the same time, I think he fits better with teammates. I think he's less of an individual on the pitch than Sanchez has been known to be at times. And I think, obviously, for Arsenal, that aspect of Sanchez's style has been at both benefit and detriment to them. In terms of replacing the goals, I'll be very surprised if he doesn't score goals in the Premier League, given his record with Dortmund, given the kind of finisher he is. I think ultimately he's someone to finish off the moves that those behind will create. That's why, to me, signing Mkhitaryan, having Ozil there for however long he decides to stay, will be of benefit, and it will, in theory, provide them that missing piece of the puzzle in attack, even if there are perhaps some concerns elsewhere on the field.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. Aubameyang averages a goal every four shots in the last five seasons, scoring 98 goals, ranking himself in the top 10 of goal scorers in Europe. But Nico, moving on to the sort of what's going to happen away from Arsenal, and maybe Olivier Giroud will be one player that's going to sort of miss out. And he's been heavily linked with Borussia Dortmund and, of course, Chelsea. Nico, where do you think the best move for both Giroud to go, and is it a good move for Chelsea, who've been searching for a target man? We've seen Andy Carroll link Peter Crouch, you know, Edin Dzeko in recent weeks. But is Olivier Giroud the perfect guy to sort of maybe unlock Chelsea's problem at the moment, that's scoring goals?
Yeah, I think he could really help him out in a goal-scoring sense, because what we know about Olivier Giroud is that he is a technically gifted footballer with his feet, but he's also really powerful in the air. And I think given, you know, the clear, concise manner in which Chelsea have gone after a very specific type of striker, Olivier Giroud fits exactly, you know, correctly into that mold. So I think given the fact that he's a little bit older and also the fact that there are a couple other strikers at Chelsea, if Batshuayi does in fact stay, and even then they still have Alvaro Morata and maybe a few players that they like to put in that kind of position, he would be played rotationally. So ideally at his age, that's what he would want to do. And it would be a nice fat paycheck for the Frenchman. So I think everybody would kind of benefit from that situation. So despite the fact that maybe he might go the other way in the Aubameyang deal, he might not. It would be a good move for him, because I think he's done exceptionally well in the Premier League and he has the qualities of a player that is likely to do really well under Antonio Conte.
I think it's quite an interesting move. I find it a little bit strange that Conte's gone for such a target man-esque striker in a way. You know, Morata is a tall guy, could be used in that role for Chelsea. But Chris, why do you think it is? Do you think it's going to be a move towards a 3-5-2, maybe Eden Hazard playing in central midfield? Or is he going to move to the 4-2-4 that he played over with Siena in Italy?
I think the 4-2-4 would be interesting, but I'm not sure if it gives them enough control, Chelsea. The 3-5-2 is an interesting one. This is where you can really get in the weeds. And I mean, I could see Hazard playing behind the front two. I don't think he would necessarily drop into central midfield. I like the thought of him coming a little bit deeper and being able to exploit that space, maybe drag central midfielders deeper with him. And even maybe give centre-backs or full-backs something to think about as he sort of floats around the pitch. What to me is key is that they have someone that I think they can rely on, because as good as Morata's been through the whole season, when you take the whole picture into consideration, he has dipped off lately, and there's been some off-the-field issues as well. You know, it was reported just the other day that sadly one of his friends had passed away from a car crash in Spain. So I think there's clearly a lot going on with him at the minute. And I think for that reason there needs to be almost a relieving of the pressure that's put on him. And I think it's less about the concerns that we had in the summer about him handling the step up to be a leading forward, and more to the fact that Chelsea really, I don't think, have someone who's ready to challenge and push him. I think Batshuayi is sort of stuck in that role as a closer rather than someone who could really start a run of games and put form together.
It is fascinating, all these moves. You know, I'd potentially say that someone like Tammy Abrahams would be perfect for what Chelsea are looking for right now, a striker that's physical, that's strong, that you could play as sort of a target man. But of course, he's out on loan at Swansea. And again, Chelsea failing to bring young players through their team. But out of this little triangle...
If you kind of look at the move as well, like I said before, Giroud is a technically gifted player. That's part of the reason that Arsene Wenger wanted him in Arsenal. He is very good with the ball at his feet and can hold the ball up really well. And if you look at a lot of the goals that Chelsea have scored this season, it has been these little quick, intricate moves between their very gifted front players and Hazard and Willian and Pedro and all those guys. And it has been all these back flicks and, you know, through balls that kind of, they do it in a very interesting way. So I think in that sense, Giroud would help them massively, because sometimes they are kind of left without an outlet. And as we've seen a number of times with Chelsea this season, they use that specific tactic of a center back passes to the forward because they like to compress the formation really well. If you have someone that is physically gifted but also technically gifted enough to match up with the players that are going to score those goals, like Hazard and Willian, then I think it's a match made in heaven in terms of immediate success. The issue is kind of going forward and how they score goals later on, because Giroud is quite old. But It looks to be a move that lines up with what they want to do tactically for the problem that you mentioned there, which is for them scoring goals.
It's an interesting one. So just for you two guys to rate these sort of transfers, if this triangle goes, so Aubameyang does go to Arsenal, Giroud to Chelsea, and Dortmund do get Batshuayi, who gets the best deal for you? First, Chris, what do you reckon?
I like Batshuayi. I'm not fully convinced by him yet. I'm not sure if he's got that sort of mean streak that I like from a star forward. I do think Aubameyang is probably the best deal of the lot, though, just because of it's the scope of improvement. That's how I look at it. Is it's not necessarily who's the best player, quote unquote. It's who's going to improve teams the most, and I think Aubameyang improves Arsenal the most.
No, it's a fair point, Nico. You're going to go with Olivier Giroud's touch and ability to hold the play up for Chelsea.
No, definitely not. I would say Batshuayi to Dortmund, or Dortmund rather, get the best deal, because he's an exceptionally gifted player. I think he's suffered from the fact that Antonio Conte has some very specific personal issues with how he likes to deal with the squad. He's really young, and what if there's anything we learned from Aubameyang over the past couple of years is that although he is a supremely physically gifted striker in terms of his, you know, as you're mentioning there, his exceptional striking ability, and as we all know, his pace, it was rather the system that created a lot of chances for him. So I think if he goes to a Dortmund that, yes, are kind of wayward right now, but one of their main issues is actually scoring goals, putting a really talented and also physically gifted striker like him in a system that does really well to create chances with another couple of really young, talented players, I think is a really good match. So for me, if that does happen, which I really hope it does, because I think a lot of people are pushing for him to have the career that we think he'll have, I think that'll be an amazing move for him.
No, it's a very interesting point. Of course, Dortmund are going to get a hell of a lot of cash as well for the Aubameyang move, around £60 million to £70 million. They're going to get a young striker in Batshuayi, which obviously Nico mentioned. Their squad, they are in a rebuilding phase. You know, they're currently, you know, very sloppy in the league. They're beating teams and then they're losing against other teams. They were 2-0 down at the weekend. It just seems to be a really weird spell for Dortmund, currently sitting sixth in the Bundesliga. So maybe it is the best deal for Borussia Dortmund, but I think I agree with Chris. Aubameyang to Arsenal is going to be a banger. Moving on to other transfer news, Manchester City spending more money on defenders, aren't they, Nico? Laporte to Manchester City. Apparently La Liga have confirmed it whilst we're talking that City have matched the release clause for the Athletic Bilbao centre-half. Nico, good deal for City. Where's Otamendi play? Is Stones going to be in there when Vincent Kompany's fit? How does Guardiola get the best out of these, say, four centre-halves? And which, for you, is the best pairing?
It's an interesting one. It's something that we discussed on the last podcast, because as I mentioned, Laporte and John Stones have some very similar attributes. They like to carry the ball into midfield. They like to draw defenders. They like to create havoc for the opposition. And though those are all attributes that I think line up well with the Guardiola system, you don't want two center backs in the team if you're going to play sort of a four-man defensive system that are going to be doing the exact same thing. And that's why I think John Stones and Nicolas Otamendi is such a good partnership, because of the contrast that they have in terms of their positive attributes. So I think it might be a move for the future, because as we saw earlier this season with Benjamin Mendy fit, it was more of a 3-5-2 type of system, or something that did feature, in fact, three at the back. So I think for the future, it might be a rotation in terms of sticking with the 4-3-3 for John Stones, as well as Nicolas Otamendi and other partners that we may see in there. Eliaquim Mangala has certainly made a case for himself to at least stay for some period of time. And if Vincent Kompany ever stays fit, then that, of course, is an option as well. But I think realistically, the move would be for all of these three defenders to play at the same time. And given the fact that we are more inclined to play a kind of wing back system with Kyle Walker and Benjamin Mendy when those players are fit, I think eventually that's where City will go. As to whether we need the player right now, I'm not 100% sure, because like I said, he's very similar to John Stones. And frankly, I think very highly of John Stones, and I haven't seen that much of Laporte in terms of consistently to say that he is better than him. But like I said, I think tactically that's where the move will end up.
Yeah, kind of. I kind of understand what Pep's doing with the, you know, a left-footed centre-half, right-footed centre-half, the angles that it opens up, and how it all comes together as a formation and a system. But Chris, again, who do you think is the best pairing there? Are you going to throw in someone like a Vincent Kompany or John Stones? For me, I love seeing Kompany and Otamendi early parts of the season, because we sort of got the best Otamendi that we've seen in the Premier League, a confident player, a player that's completing passes for fun and taking the play. Chris, do you think it's needed? Or a Bilbao just, you know, making some more money?
I mean, the difficulty is for Bilbao is that the release clause has been paid. I mean, it's just been confirmed as we are talking right now that the clause has been paid and that Laporte has released his farewell message. So I don't really think they've had a huge say in it. They've known City have been interested for a while. They tried to play the clause and get the deal done, I think, 2015. But Laporte didn't feel he was ready. In terms of why City are choosing to do it now, I imagine they're partially influenced by the fact that as good as Kompany is and as good as he was at the weekend against Cardiff, there's still concerns and there's no reliability from his body and whether that can hold up. And I think once you sort of remove Kompany from that discussion as a reliable, consistent centre-back, you are kind of left with Stones and Otamendi. And I think as the back end of the season sort of comes into view, it's not just the Premier League that you've got to consider. There's the Champions League, which I think City have a fantastic opportunity to really make some headway in. You then have the League Cup final. They're still in the FA Cup, of course. So they're on, theoretically, for a quadruple. And I think that's where they just want that little bit of a security policy and a little bit of depth, because I don't think they trust Mangala. And I can kind of understand that, because when he has played, he hasn't looked that convincing to me this season. So yeah, I think from their perspective, essentially what City are doing and what I think they've started to do a lot more now is essentially buy before they need. And I can't necessarily fault that as a recruitment strategy, because if you've got the financial resources to do it, I think it makes a lot of sense, because it means you're not scrabbling around trying to do deals late in the day like some clubs I can think of.
No, it's a fair point. I quite like the fact that City are, you know, they are stockpiling talent. It's an interesting strategy. It's almost what Chelsea do at youth level, but at professional level. Now City have four of the top five players in terms of most expensive defenders in world football, and the second most expensive goalkeeper. It's an interesting, you know, line that the club peddle. Of course, the Alexis Sanchez was too expensive for them, but yet they're spending £57 million on a defender it looks like they don't really need in terms of their squad. But that is Manchester City for you in the modern day. Moving on from Manchester City, let's talk about your club, Chris. Newcastle. We're not even going to let you have a stab at that, Nico. That is just going to be me dropping some bombs. No questions asked. But anyway, moving on to Daniel Sturridge. An interesting one for you, Chris, because your club Newcastle were heavily linked this morning to sign Daniel Sturridge, but apparently he didn't travel up north for his medical. Chris, are you sad? Are you upset? Do you think he would have been a perfect fit for Newcastle United?
He would have been a really good option. I mean, I say that, again, I have concerns not dissimilar to company. His injury record isn't great. I was a little bit concerned how he would fit in a team that was looking to run a lot and is very much founded on the idea that they have to cover a lot of ground defensively, because that's sort of how they press. It's not quite aggressive. It's a little bit more standoffish and requiring hard work. And how does a body hold up like that? I couldn't see him, because he's obviously going to West Brom now. I couldn't see him filling that role that, say, Dwight Gayle or Hosolu plays, because he's not as big as Hosolu and he's not as mobile, I would argue, as Dwight Gayle. He is a brilliant finisher. And for that reason alone, I think, it would have been a benefit. How he fits in, how he would have fit in exactly, I'm not sure, but thankfully, that's not something I really have to think about that now, because he's not going to be coming at all.
Would have been quite nice to see him at number 10, maybe, like taking the Pablo Aimar role. Of course, Pablo Aimar did work hard for Rafa Benitez as Valencia, but again, he had that sort of creative freedom and, you know, getting on. I think Daniel Sturridge has probably lost that yard of pace that he had at Liverpool, those explosive. So it is sort of a moving Daniel Sturridge, and it will be interesting at West Brom. You think they've got some good wingers around them, the likes of Matt Phillips, you know, slinging balls into the box, a partnership with maybe Rondon or a Jay Rodriguez, or, you know, Ollie Burke out wide. It's a really interesting move, and Pardew, for all his, you know, his miscomings, the dance at Wembley, the failure at Newcastle after he, you know, had such a good season when he finished fifth, it's quite interesting that, again, he's building a squad at West Brom that looks surprisingly attractive compared to Tony Pulis's side. So it is an interesting move once again. But your favourite player in the Premier League, Nico, of course, Morgan Schneiderlin, the greatest midfielder, right, to bless the Premier League, is on his way to West Ham United. Chris, Nico, do you think it's someone that would fit in at David Moyes' side? Is there a player you can see then that he can come in for, or sort of change in tactics at all?
I mean, I haven't seen that much of West Ham or Morgan Schneiderlin for a long time. Was hoping to see a lot of him at Manchester United, but that didn't quite work out, did it? But yeah, he's a really exceptionally gifted defensive midfielder. I think he's a really good passer. We saw his ability at Southampton. But in terms of how he fits in at West Ham, I think he adds another player to this system that, you know, David Moyes has done well to kind of keep steady and put West Ham back on at least a relatively stable path. And I think he's another good player that they'll probably add to their team, which is a good move. But I do have something to say about Daniel Sturridge as well, which is, what does this say about, you know, and this, of course, no disrespect to Chris's club, Newcastle, but I mean, I highly doubt that there wasn't at least a hint or some possibility of a move for a player like him to go outside of the Premier League. And yet the only links that we're seeing inside of it are the only links that we're seeing of the player as the window closes are for inside of it. I mean, is it a case of Jack Wilshere again, where he didn't really want to go to Roma, and this is a consistent thing for English players that they just don't want to go abroad for? I mean, probably for monetarily motivated reasons, but I mean, for a player that has enjoyed a career like he has, where there's a ton of promise, but at the same time, maybe difficulty staying on the field and other issues as well. I think it would be massively beneficial for him to go somewhere outside of the Premier League. Am I wrong?
No, I think it's sort of England being separate from mainland Europe in a way where at school, I don't think we're not pushed language as much as they are in France and Germany. And in a way, it is a bit sad that we're not seeing someone like a Daniel Sturridge, someone like a Jack Wilshere applying their trade in a Serie A. Obviously, it'll be better for the English game. You know, that experience, whether it is at a playing level, coming back from a Roma and having this experience of how tactical Italy is, whether it's from a coaching perspective or a player perspective, that's always good for English football in a way. One player maybe returning from Spain, Delafeo, maybe moving to Watford on loan. Of course, Javier Garcia took over from Marco Silva last week and be looking to bring in the former Everton man. But just to finish things off, this little section, the transfer section, we'll ask you two lads, who has done the best business so far in January and who do you think will have the best last week of the window? Chris, you first.
I'm inclined to say Arsenal because I think they've signed a few different players and they've addressed some, if not all, of their needs, which I think is all you can ask from this situation.
Fair play, Nico. Who do you think has addressed the problems the best? Chelsea? Manchester City?
Possibly. Like I said before, I really liked the Batshuayi to Dortmund move. They're in an interesting place, but that's kind of what, you know, their MO as a club, not necessarily being inconsistent at bad results, but they have to do this kind of business because ultimately they are a feeder club. They're not exactly of the pedigree of a Barcelona or a top five club in Europe, but they are consistently there because of the way that they run their club, both from a financial and a development perspective. So I think this is just one of those cycles that they have to enter. Their plan of pushing Thomas Tuchel through with a bunch of really gifted players and achieving success through that didn't fall through because players left, things happened, things that they couldn't foresee. So this is just a restart to their cycle. And I think having someone like Batshuayi, losing Ousmane Dembele, but bringing in other talented youngsters is just a part of the process for them. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if we see them reemerge to the talented heights that we saw under Jurgen Klopp or something like that in a few years. I would say probably it's difficult to say Arsenal, not because I disagree with the points that Chris made, but because all of these moves don't really have a vision for anything farther than 2 years down the road. And that's really difficult to do when you're trying to be a consistent top four club again. And so in that sense, I think it's something that is going to be really fun and interesting to watch in terms of immediate payoff. But from a long-term perspective, I think it's a disaster because how do you replace these players in a few years? You have an interesting wage structure that you have to deal with. And from how we've seen Arsenal run for the past couple of years, I don't see how they could handle that exceptionally well.
It is interesting. Clubs like Dortmund, like Southampton are a great example of, a club in the UK that do sell players and look to recruit. They've had a bit of a problem recently, like Sadio Mane, Graziano Pella being let go, and nobody really coming in and replacing them. Chris, do you think this sort of sell-to-buy model is impossible to maintain long-term? Like, you have to be getting your scouting right every single time. We saw a great Dortmund side taken apart over the years when they couldn't maintain that. Do you think it's impossible, Chris?
I think it isn't, unfortunately. I think you look at the teams that are the biggest proponents of this, like Southampton, like Monaco, like Ajax. This season, you've seen a drop-off in all three in some form or another. Monaco aren't able to keep pace with PSG, who, granted, have been sensational compared to last season. Ajax are second behind PSV. They obviously crashed out of the Champions League or the European qualifications. Well, they lost to Rosenborg of all teams, which again is not a game I expected them to lose. And Southampton, who have gone from a team that I think we all looked at as perhaps the model for a club that looks to rise through the divisions and establish itself, to now they're in a position where they're banking on Guido Carrillo from Monaco firing them to safety with this final chapter of the Premier League season coming about. So I think the problem comes in almost knowing, not necessarily when to sell, but how much you can theoretically sell. I think the problem is it's the scope of change that inevitably leaves you counting the cost of things. I mean, granted, Ajax didn't really sell a huge number of players, so they haven't seen what I would consider a drastic drop off. It was more really about them losing Peter Bosz than anything else. But I look at Monaco, who between Bakayoko and Mbappe, Bernardo Silva, there's three key players in that team. And really, I would say only Keita Balde has come in and hit the ground running. And that's the problem, I think, there, is that you need those new faces to come in and hit the ground running. And as I'm sure, you know, many people will tell you in football, and speaking with just a little bit of experience, there are so many different variables that go into a new player arriving at a football club that can theoretically stop them having that bright start. From just settling into a new system to settling into a new area, all of these different things that can influence it. So no, I think ultimately it's not. If you are almost too aggressive in the way that you sell and then look to buy.
I think you've got to take your time. I think that's the big thing. I think it is all about long term. And unfortunately in football, fans want the short term. You know, you take Monaco as a good example. They lost to Mbappe, one of the best young forwards in world football, but they have replaced him in this window, Pietro Pellegrini. Is that right? Pellegrini from Genoa, 16-year-old. They've signed him for £17 million yesterday. That is, of course, Sunday to anyone listening to this podcast a little bit later on. But, you know, a wonderful young talent. I think that's the big thing. Southampton have lacked goals. On the flip side of that, they're looking at someone like Quincy Pons in this transfer window from Spartak Moscow. So I think it's possible, but you've got to have patience. And I think that's the big thing. Southampton, what they're looking like, they're going to sack their manager this season. They sacked their manager last season. A manager like Claude Puel that showed that he is a very good manager, you know, take what he's done at Leicester City. So it's like sort of like managing this short-term mentality with long-term gains in a way. But that is all very interesting. That is enough diving into the transfers in and around the world, talking point number one. On to talking point number two. We are just going to be talking Arsenal and Aubameyang. And how he fits in, where does Lacazette play, and so.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fourth. Where will Aubameyang play for Arsenal? What system do you think they're going to play? What's he going to bring to this side?
It's an interesting one because you would probably think of him as an out-and-out striker, as he's sort of played for Dortmund in the past couple of years in a single kind of striker system. But then, of course, you have Lacazette, you have other attacking players in that system, like Mesut Ozil and now Henrik Mkhitaryan, that they all, I mean, we would imagine that they all need to share the pitch at the same time. So I think probably some semblance of a front four is what we're going to see at Arsenal for a little bit, because I imagine that they'd want to have all of these attacking players on the pitch at the same time. With that being said, they don't really play like Mesut Ozil as a number 10. He's very fluid. He comes from midfield. He can pop up in different spaces. So in terms of what that means for the forwards, you still have to incorporate that this is going to be a three-back system. So I imagine we might see some semblance of a 3-4-3, with Mesut Ozil sort of roaming from that midfield four, which yet again kind of fits into that, to what we've said about Arsene Wenger in recent weeks, which is that, you know, their attack is excellent. They create a ton of chances. We saw that against Manchester United, which are, you know, probably one of the best defensive teams out there up until that point. But the defensive issues come from the way that they structure their team, and that's kind of going to be the issue going forward for Arsenal, is that they have this system that's going to be extremely unbalanced, because you have all these attacking players that, you know, not all of them are going to do the defensive work that you ask of them, but then you're creating a ton going forward because of the players that you have on the pitch. So in terms of what Aubameyang would bring to that system, I think he'd work well with Lacazette, but it's going to be a weird one. What are you seeing, Dave?
I just think it's a bit of a strange transfer. You've just coughed up £30 million to buy Ligue 1's best striker in the last few seasons in Lacazette, and now you've signed another number nine in the next window. Again, it's all about this long-term, short-term business. If you were to play a 3-4-2-1, Mesut Ozil isn't going to be playing in central midfield because that just wouldn't work. Arsenal would be so open if they played a single pivot in midfield with, you know, a front four of Lacazette, Ozil, Mickey and Aubameyang. That'd be absolutely crazy. It's quite interesting. I think Aubameyang will be good in the Premier League, but I think the thing with Arsenal fans is that they may get on his back and his confidence might go. Aubameyang is a Cavani type forward that will miss a number of chances. I rewatched the Dortmund-Gladbach game from earlier on in the season, 6-1, a cracking game. But Aubameyang pretty much had 8 clear-cut chances. He had 8 shots on goal, and he scored 3. He scored a hat-trick. But you think someone that would be, you know, like a Lionel Messi in that game, or Cristiano Ronaldo, obviously not in the current form, but in previous seasons, would be scoring 8 goals. And I think that is what you've got to get with Aubameyang. If you're an Arsenal fan, you've got to know that he will miss chances. He's your classic, like, Andy Cole type forward that has loads of chances, gets into loads of really good positions, loves running the blind side of defenders, loves attacking the space in between either a fullback and a centre half or between the two centre backs. He's always making that move and using his pace and almost waiting for his teammates to create. But it's going to be frustrating at some points for Aubameyang. And with Lacazette in there, does Lacazette move to the left wing? It's going to be quite interesting. Mkhitaryan as well, you know, bringing into this equation, Chris. Do you think the forward line of Lacazette, Ozil, Mkhitaryan, Aubameyang, and maybe a 4-2-3-1 could be where Arsenal are going, and Lacazette is the guy that's going to be forced out wide?
I think so. I mean, the thing is, Lacazette, I think, started his career out wide. At least that's where I remember seeing him many, many years ago in what I think was the Emirates Cup for Lyon. He was quite a pacey player that looked to break him behind from out wide. I'm not sure if he's still that same player now, and I think actually it would be quite frustrating for him to learn that he's going to be pushed out wide, because I think the intention was when he arrived that he was going to be that central striker that he had become at Lyon. The 4-2-3-1 is obviously something that Wenger admires a lot. It's a formation that he seems to put a lot of stock in. It's arguably the one I would associate most with him, in fact, as I look at his career at Arsenal and his lack of flexibility or willingness to shift from that, I think, has at times cost him. You would say, though, that Aubameyang fits that 4-2-3-1 very well. So for me, it seems painfully obvious that that's probably going to be the formation that they use. And then where the Mkhitaryan and Ozil fit into that, I'm not entirely sure. Perhaps they interchange with one of the wide positions in a central position during the course of a game.
I think that could be the problem. I think if you give these attacking players so much creative freedom, what are they going to do in the defensive sense? And we may see teams counter-attacking Arsenal, you know, 3-on-2, as we have done over the last few seasons. Quite interesting in terms of Mkhitaryan this season in the Premier League. I don't think that he's failed at Manchester United. No, this season only Pogba's got more Premier League assists than Mkhitaryan. Mkhitaryan's only played twice since October. But one way that they could all fit together maybe is a 4-4-2 shape. We've seen that, you know, emerge over the last few seasons as a dominant formation in Europe with, you know, 4 out of the 4 teams played a 4-4-2 or apparently a 4-4-2 in the Champions League semi-finals, Nico. Do you think that a 4-4-2 or maybe a 4-2-2-2 could work for Arsenal with both Lacazette and Aubameyang up front?
I mean, it's difficult. For me, the difficult thing to see here is who will be providing the work out wide, because we have, for me, the 4 players that we're kind of talking about here in Lacazette, Aubameyang, Ozil, and Mkhitaryan, they're all kind of central players with maybe the exception of Mkhitaryan, who can do some good things out wide, but you wouldn't imagine that he wants to be there for the entire game. He wants to cut inside. He wants to create things centrally. And that's the consistent thing about Arsenal, is that I think Arsene Wenger has rightly identified that that's the best way to try and penetrate teams, to try to create chances, is to create problems and draw teams out of the middle. And all 4 of these players are good at doing that. Lacazette has incredible ability to link up with players in the middle, and Aubameyang has that good ability to run in behind, as well as, you know, kind of strike through the middle of the pitch. As you mentioned there, he likes to attack the middle of the center back, so the space between the center back and the fullback. the issue is, I wonder if this is as I've talked about with Chris before, I think, is that there are certain points of the Arsenal system where simply too much work or too much pressure is asked of certain players in the system. We've seen it before with the defensive midfielders, and possibly now with sort of the fullback, sort of wingback type players, because if we're asking them to do all of the work of keeping the width of the pitch and keeping that defensive work wide, then I just don't see those players having a whole lot of success for a sustained period of time, because that's the issue with the four players, is that I don't see Mesut Ozil doing a ton of defensive work. I don't see Aubameyang necessarily doing a ton of work, though he was in a pressing system at Dortmund, as well as, you know, Henrik Mkhitaryan is a versatile player, and he definitely likes to go back and forth. But ideally, that's not where you want to what you want to see him doing for 90 or however many minutes on the pitch. So once again, it's just weird how they're going to fit all of these pieces together, which I'm sure in some sense they will from an attacking perspective. The issue for Arsenal yet again here is that they will falter defensively. They will have issues at the back because of how much they're putting forward.
So again, maybe another sort of stage of Arsenal's bad recruitment policy. You know, they have brought in Sven Mislintat from Borussia Dortmund, who did bring Mkhitaryan, Aubameyang, Ousmane Dembele to Dortmund. But again, as you mentioned, Nico, is he buying the right pieces to solve the puzzle at Arsenal? Or maybe he's looking to bring Thomas Tuchel to the club, which obviously fell out at Dortmund, right?
Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing also, is that for me, sometimes when you see these things in the media, like, for example, when Louis van Gaal went to Manchester United, we saw links with him, you know, continuous links with him in Dutch players. And then sometimes when you have managers go to a different club, you see links with their previous players, which is fine. But when you have that from a recruitment perspective, someone that's solely supposed to be responsible for bringing in new players to the club that are supposed to aid the club going forward, and all they want to do is go back to previously used ideas, that doesn't scream, you know, invention from the person that's supposed to be giving you sort of gems. And especially in Arsenal's financial situation, where they don't want to spend as, you know, vicariously as a Manchester City or a Manchester United, they need to have out of the park home runs with some of these players. And buying 28 or 29 or 30 year olds and past ideas and these players that might not fit too well together in a system, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense in the immediacy. And that's the criticism for Arsenal, is that not just financially does this not seem feasible, but also from a player perspective, it doesn't seem entirely feasible.
It's an interesting one, obviously losing a star in Alexis Sanchez and replacing him with Mkhitaryan, with an Aubameyang. It does kind of work, but at the same time, it's not Alexis Sanchez, which moves us on to talking point number three, and that is Alexis Sanchez's debut for Manchester United and the instant impact he made on Mourinho's side. Nico, what did you think of his performance against Yeovil Town on Friday night?
I didn't get to see it, Dave. But
missed it.
but it was against Yeovil Town, so I can't imagine the quality of opposition was all too great, was it?
What like these? This is a professional football club. Why are you disrespecting Yeovil Town?
They're in League Two. I'm not disrespecting Yeovil Town.
They've been up and down the leagues for a side. Like, this is the problem with football at the moment. Why is it that a player plays well against, you know, a smaller team, and it's like, oh, well, even though he played well, it doesn't matter because that they were only league.
Of course,
it's just utter rubbish, right? You look at his stats, for example, when he was on the pitch, he had more touches than any other player on it, the most passes, the most chances created, the most shots, the most crosses. The guy did everything.
And Alexis Sanchez, Dave, does bring up an interesting question, and I'll ask this of you. And we've been talking and kind of moaning about Arsenal's transfer policy and what it means for them in the immediacy. And I think the stark contrast between them and Arsenal is that they can afford to make these kind of moves. They can afford to pay what they've paid for Alexis Sanchez, both in the transfer whatever and also the wages, because of, you know, what they have financially as a club. In the immediacy, how do you see that affecting Manchester United, and how well does he fit into the system with all of the other attacking players that seem to kind of be shoehorned into the squad at times?
Nico, United haven't spent any money on Alexis Sanchez. They've simply
spent a considerable amount for his wages, rather, and it does impact the wage structure in some way, shape, or form. And he is 29. That is the only criticism that I think some people might have of this transfer.
Deal. Play until he's 33 at Man United. He gets paid whatever he gets paid a week. It's not my money. It's not any United fans' money. Man United are the best in the best position in terms of finance. The Forbes list came out last week. United were top
exactly.
again.
That's why that they can make these, they can do that sort of thing because of who they are as a club. Now, how does that impact the team in the immediacy?
But it's a positive thing, right? You saw his performance against Yeovil Town. Yeah, it's Yeovil Town, but I expect Alexis Sanchez to have a similar input against Spurs. I think the problem with Manchester United is maybe a lack of identity in the final third, and what you've got with Alexis Sanchez is a true identity. Yes, he plays a lot of high percentage passes, but if one of those passes comes off, like the assist he got for Ander Herrera, that was a brilliant counter-attack that was led by the Chilean, like that's not a problem for me. I think it's a wonderful signing. I think what you'll see from young players like Marcus Rashford, like Anthony Martial, is that they'll be able to learn from Sanchez's his work rate, his determination. United's two big problems for me are both, you know, in an attacking sense, sometimes they run out of ideas in the final third and just simply cross the ball. With someone like a playmaker there, that's what Sanchez is. He's a playmaker where you get the ball as much as you can and you let him do what he wants to do. If he loses the ball, he loses it. It's your job to win it back. It's Nemanja Matic's job. It's the fullbacks. It's the centre-halves. It's the central midfielders. It's the striker. But having someone like Alexis Sanchez who has that quality is, you know, it massively, massively updates United's team and updates their style. You think about the pressing as well, something United have lacked over the last, let's say since Louis van Gaal, under Mourinho, United haven't pressed as well. When you've got someone like Sanchez on your side that is hungry, that can get a team going, it's just very exciting to see what United can become, especially in these bigger games. Sanchez potentially playing through the middle against, like a Manchester City, and stopping them build up. I think the brilliant thing that Liverpool did against City recently was that they caught them out when the centre-halves had the ball in certain phases. It wasn't an aggressive press, it was a phase press where they identified certain situations and they jumped out and that they nicked the ball in the high areas and they transitioned down the flanks, as they've got to do. You've got someone like Alexis Sanchez who can do that. Then you throw another pace of players in that lineup, like a Lukaku, like a Martial. That becomes a real dangerous front three. And in a way, unfortunately for American soccer and the MLS, there's a new MLS in the world football. And that is, of course, Martial, Lukaku and Alexis Sanchez. But moving a bit further on, we're going to talk about recruitment for Manchester United. Nico, do United need to do any more recruitment in this window?
I think you were mentioning sort of in the run up to the podcast as we were talking about that you think that Manchester United need a central midfielder. And I don't know if I completely agree with that, but I would certainly say that about Manchester City. And in fact, they are supposedly in for the same midfielder in Jean-Michel Seri. How do you feel about that move, dude?
It's an interesting one. What I like at the moment is that after United have pipped City to this big transfer, every single player that City are buying, apparently, has been leaked somewhere that United have been interested to. Yet, the respected United journalists who get leaks directly from the club, there's no talk of it at all. But it's an interesting one. Someone like Asari would be an interesting proposition for the United midfield. More of a worker, more of a shuffler. Does get through his passing work, but he's not going to, you know, unlock a defence. He was about to move to Barcelona, then they pulled out the deal in the summer. But I'd prefer maybe someone a little bit more aggressive, someone more with a bit more physicality to him and goals. Someone like a Milinkovic-Savic from Lazio could be quite interesting. Watch the Lazio AC Milan game at the weekend. It's a cracking game. Of course, Gattuso, AC Milan manager at the moment, got slapped on the head by his entire team after the final whistle because he said he'd allow them to do that if they performed. And of course, they won. There was some good performances from the likes of Suso, ex-Liverpool, and Calhanoglu, ex-Bayer Leverkusen. But in terms of what Milinkovic-Savic did in the game, he was abrasive, he worked as a shuffler in this sort of 3-5-1-1 that Lazio play. He had a number of big chances and didn't take them, unfortunately, but he was getting into the right areas. And he's a real threat physically, and I think that's what you bring to Manchester United. It's almost the next evolved form of Marouane Fellaini. I don't think Marouane Fellaini is the most technically gifted player, but Savic has the physicality, has the height, and also he's got the ability on the ball to move it around. So it'd be really interesting, one playing him and Paul Pogba partnering in midfield together. But I think with United, it's going to be the 4-3-3 this season especially. But with Mesut Ozil heavily, heavily linked with the move to the club, I'm not sure that it will be that, and it may be moving to the 4-2-3-1. Nico, what do you expect for United, the 4-3-3 or the 4-2-3-1 in the long term?
I think it's the 4-3-3. It really kind of brings out some of the best attributes of those players that have been at United for a little bit and, you know, haven't had the greatest deal of consistency up until now. Specifically, Anthony Martial. I think a 4-3-3 gets the best out of him. And when you have him taking on players in the wing in isolated areas, you're going to create a ton of chances and really good chances, because he's not only going to get to the byline like maybe a traditional English winger or an English team would prefer, he's going to be, you know, having those really high quality low crosses into the box. And when you have someone like Lukaku who's able to finish those chances really well, I think that's kind of the best of what you want. And then kind of whoever you want to put out on the right, whether it be a mystery player in the future, whoever United end up recruiting, or for right now maybe Alexis Sanchez, that's a match made in heaven, as it were, because you have chance creation from both sides if you can isolate those players on the wing. So 4-3-3 for me.
I think this three-man midfield is what United should build around, be it a 4-3-3 or 3-5-2, depending on whether United are playing against a back three or a back two. You think Paul Pogba has grabbed 7 assists in the last month or two, and that's all sort of been when he's been playing as a central midfielder and a three-man midfield. I think it gives him better space. I think it's the sort of interesting side to it. He's a little bit more freedom, and he can overlap the winger, he can underlap. And in the 4-2-3-1, if he's playing as part of the double pivot, a little bit more restricted, but it will be interesting going forward for Manchester United. Of course, Sanchez, I think he will play on the left wing, and where Martial plays, maybe on rotation or maybe on the right. I think it's only going to be a good thing for Anthony Martial. I think Martial should develop his game as a forward that can play on both flanks. I think that's something you need to do, and eventually maybe playing as a striker. And it's all about developing him, his brain, and identifying certain situations. Again, if he plays eventually as a striker, when he's drifting out to the right wing, you want him to be comfortable in that area. So maybe it will be Sanchez on the left, Lukaku through the middle, and Martial on the right. But what I want to see is a lot of interchange of those three positions at Manchester United. What a debut for Alexis Sanchez. What a signing. Back in the title race, Nico.
Definitely not, Dave. The gap is still 12 points, I believe. So I don't think they're going to close that gap anytime soon.
It's been done before, Nico, and it could be done again. I think we have lost Kristen Hennage to the wide world. Oh, no, Kristen Hennage has returned. So, Kristen, your thoughts on the Alexis Sanchez debut against Yeovil Town, just to finish things off.
I thought you saw the best and the worst of him. at his best, he set up the goal for Ander Herrera, showed some really great decision-making in the final third in terms of he had a lot of options and he ultimately picked the best one. There was a lot of industry, there was a lot of energy to him. He constantly wanted the ball, which I think is always a good sign for any player, because it's very easy to disappear in games like that, and just in general. I think at its worst, you saw him almost drifting inside a bit too much, wanting to be involved in everything. And sometimes, in the words of the late, great Johan Cruyff, the best way to help your teammate is to move away from them, not come closer towards them. But I think even saying that, it's being a little bit hypercritical. I think you got everything you could kind of expect from him. The money should hopefully fade into the background now, because really it means absolutely nothing in the grand scheme of things. And I'll be curious to see how he melds with the rest of that attacking lineup, because he's obviously a wonderful player. He's used to being more of a leader, I think, in the final third, someone that starts things, tries to finish things, whereas Manchester United don't really need that. I think they need a supplement, not someone to organise the whole band. So I'm curious to see maybe what changes Mourinho makes to his game to get the most out of him.
Yeah, interesting thoughts. I'd probably say United do need someone to lead the band in the final third. I think there's a lot of young players there. I think there's somebody, there is a space for leadership there. And Sanchez, for me, is the perfect guy. But anyway, guys, that has been that for the front three this week. New format, three talking points. We may add something next week, so stay tuned to that. But it will be three more guys next week. We're going to rotate the guys. Maybe Lars will turn up once in a while. Adam Boltwood again, talking about how Spurs have failed him. But anyway, till next week, Chris, where can the good listeners of the front three find you? What are you writing about this week? What's going down in Chris Hennage land?
Nothing really to write about this week thus far. That can always change, thankfully, but you can find me at K Hennage.
Nico, are you writing about Juventus? Are you writing about Barcelona? What's going down?
I will probably be writing something about both of those teams soon. I know I'm making a video on Juventus pretty soon, but I did write something recently about Manchester City and sort of their style of play and how the English football culture affects Manchester City. So if you want to give that a read, you can visit my profile on Twitter, and I'm sure it's on there somewhere, at @Nico_O'Morales.
That's been that. It is over.
It is over.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.